Good morning. My name's Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. First of all, the words of welcome from Senator Rockefeller, Bob Graham, and the rest of our board of directors, but a word of thanks for everybody who began their post-holiday work period, as we say here in Washington, delving into one of the toughest and naughtiest problems that healthcare faces, which, of course, is healthcare costs. And we're going to talk today about two of the most prominent aspects of that, and that is chronic care for chronic conditions and the role of technology in healthcare costs. I want to thank, first of all, our friends at the Kaiser Family Foundation, Diane and Roland and her colleagues, for not only helping to support and sponsor this series, but offering us this wonderful facility in which to have the discussion. You'll notice that we've configured the seats, those of you who were here for the first of this three briefing series, in a way that we hope will encourage everyone around the table, and I see a lot of illustrious faces around this table, to get into the conversation, and we've reserved a fair amount of time for that to happen. So don't be bashful. I don't see anyone around here who would usually be characterized that way. So we will look forward to contributions from everybody sitting around the square. Thanks also to everyone whose logo and name appears on the screens above you. We have had broad and very gratifying support from a variety of parts of the healthcare world, and every organization represented there has been extremely helpful, not just in financially supporting the series, but helping us to plan it out and make sure we had the right folks around the table. And finally, let me just reiterate our thanks to our informal advisory board, chaired by John Rother from the National Commission Coalition on Healthcare, who's also a member of our board. There is a sheet describing those folks in your materials, and each of them played a big role in shaping the series itself, both the content and the format, in a way that we hope will make this whole thing a very productive exercise. We're pleased and actually quite fortunate to have guiding us through this entire series Susan Denser of Health Affairs, whom I will not say anything nice about because you know all the good things about her. We're just very happy that she's here to make sure that everybody gets a chance to make the contribution that they're capable of doing. Susan, let me turn it over to you and have a great discussion.
Thank you very much, Ed. Good morning to all of you, and welcome back to work. Those of you who were at our first session will know that when we open up a conversation about healthcare costs, it's very difficult to confine that conversation to a couple of discrete contributors to healthcare costs. We tried valiantly to do that in the first session and failed, miserably. We will probably do that again today, just because, of course, as we all know, there are multiple determinants of higher healthcare spending. And these don't tend to exist in discrete silos. They very much interact with each other. But once again, today we're going to try to stay on a couple of discrete contributors to healthcare spending and healthcare costs to the degree we can do that. And as you know, as Ed said today, we're going to be talking about technology and chronic conditions as drivers of healthcare spending and healthcare costs. We, of course, are attempting to understand not just the role that these play in contributing to the healthcare costs and spending issues, but also in particular to start to discuss what is actionable. What can we actually do about these things? Are there policy initiatives that would address them that would not contravene some of our other goals in having a robust healthcare environment that does address our needs? So what we will hear this tension throughout the conversation today as we discuss some of the actionable, potentially actionable policy solutions, but recognize that there are trade-offs involved in embracing them all. To get us started, we're delighted to have two speakers, Joe Antos from American Enterprise Institute and Ken Thorpe from Emory, to speak respectively about the roles of technology in chronic conditions. And we're very happy to have Joe here with us today. He decided to have an authentic healthcare experience over the weekend in order to have a legitimate grip on his subject. But Joe managed to come back from a case of sciatica and be with us today. And Joe, thank you so much for being here. We know it was only with considerable effort that you were able to join us, and we appreciate that. So Joe, we're going to start with you. Joe has a presentation, and then we'll move directly into Ken's presentation. Joe, all yours.
Thank you. What we aim at, that thing? We'll see in a minute. Oh, okay. All right, there we are. So I promised to stay on the subject for, I promised to stay on the subject for whole minutes at a time, technology. And, of course, you saw the picture of Marcus Welby. If you got up this morning and took a pill, you used medical technology. And that's probably what almost everybody in this room did. I took quite a few pills. They didn't do much good. Rick, get to work. But virtually everybody, what's that?
Need incentives.
I'll be getting into that in just a second. So Rick has already taken me off of technology and onto my favorite topic. But, Marcus Welby, that instrument that he's using, that was probably the best one that he had in those days. The reason he went to your home to visit you, he took that black bag. What was in it? It was a stethoscope, something that had been available since the Greeks, and basically nothing else. They had a thermometer, too. Okay, good deal. Healthcare is not practiced that way anymore. And I think mostly we could say that's a good thing. So there's the contrast to Marcus Welby. That is a proton beam therapy chamber. It's somewhat controversial, but the one thing you can be sure about it is it's expensive. And it's always interesting to know how these things work. So here's a nice schematic, and you can see that there are these various gantries to treat patients, and the alleged power source is the cyclotron. But of course, we know that isn't true. The real power source, of course, is money. If we didn't have big demand for this kind of technology, we wouldn't spend the money. It's the money that drives the system. So I'm glad I got past technology so I can now talk about economics. Now, seriously, I'll go back to technology in a minute. But that's the point. It's, as Susan said, the various sources of healthcare cost growth that people have attributed over the years are not separable. And in particular, they all have their root in either the supply of something or the demand for something. And since it's a market economy, it means money. And in this particular case, it's both supply and demand. So anyway, here's something that I found in someone else's presentation. I thought it was very interesting. This does reflect the march of cost of technology and, of course, the march of progress. The traditional technology, which it's not clear that that's really traditional. The real traditional technology, of course, is something that caveman did. So this is really kind of advanced stuff since about 1910 or so. But we'll take it. And you can see that over time, we've gone to more and more sophisticated equipment. And every time there's a new generation of equipment, it seems as if the cost is higher. Now, what I can't tell you for sure is whether this is in price-adjusted terms, but it probably doesn't matter. I think the impression is undoubtedly correct. But it's, you know, when people talk about technology, they usually think about pieces of equipment. Of course, it's not just pieces of equipment. It's essentially everything that a doctor does. I mentioned drugs. Obviously, that's part of technology. Equipment is part of technology, not just the equipment that is, you know, in the hospital up against a wall, some big thing, but also the little things. The stethoscopes work a lot better these days to pick on the thing that I mentioned that Marcus Welby had. But also, it's medical technique, and I think that's part of technology, too. It's knowing how to do something. Even if the basic materials are the same as they were 20 years ago, but you now know how to do it, that is an advance in technology. And all of that adds to both the supply of services that are available to treat disease and diagnose disease, and also the demand for such diagnoses and treatments. Now, one of the things that you'll see in the literature, which I've never particularly found useful. I'm an old labor economist at heart, but technology. You'll see these studies that try to parse out how much of cost growth is accountable for by various kinds of factors, including technology. And technology is that one thing that can't be directly measured. Although I'd argue that the other factors that people usually point to aren't really all that measurable either. But everybody admits that technology is not directly measurable. And so technology is usually treated as a residual. So it's not technology. It's the I don't know factor. So if you see somebody say technology is responsible for 60% of cost growth over some period of time, maybe not. It's just not at all clear. And technology alone, as Susan said, technology alone is not the culprit. It's everything. But in the end, if there wasn't money to buy it, and if people didn't want it, and if doctors weren't prepared to do it, then that piece of technology wouldn't be used. So it's more complicated than I think most studies are capable, most empirical studies are capable of dealing with. Okay, so when you have better technology, you generally have better care. Not uniformly, but over the vast span of time, we see this to be the case. And my example is cataract surgery. There's some evidence that a crude form of cataract surgery that was literally somebody putting a stick in your eye was practiced sometime in the Babylonian era. But more concrete evidence. There's some evidence in the 16th century of something called couching, which is essentially sticking a fancy stick in your eye. That didn't work too well, probably wasn't used very often, and, of course, there wasn't anesthesia at that time, so you had to really want to do it. In the 60s, you know, there's hundreds of years later, vast improvement. In inpatient operation, we'd learned something about infection. So in the 60s, we're far more capable of dealing with infection. That was a technological improvement. But it was risky. This was the kind of thing that you used a sharp knife, probably sharper than you're likely to find on the streets of Washington any evening, probably a little smaller. But it's the same basic principle. Essentially, because this was so risky, very few patients ever got it. It was always reserved for those patients who literally couldn't see out of that eye, often only had one operation. And the idea was to extract the lens. And after the operation, which was highly risky, they sewed things up, and then the patient was held in the hospital room for at least 2 weeks with sandbags so they wouldn't move. Very uncomfortable. Not so many patients were willing to try it. And those who were willing to try it were absolutely at the end of their ropes. That wasn't that long ago. So then we move to today, and I'm not sure when today started, probably sometime in the last 15 or 20 years. We have a much more sophisticated procedure. Doctors are looking through microscopes to make sure that they are cutting exactly in the right place. They're using more sophisticated procedure to take care of the lens. They replace the lens with something that makes you see better than you ever saw in your life. And even better, They pick you up. You're a Medicare patient, which only the unfortunate few don't make it to Medicare before this happens. But if you are a Medicare patient, they pick you up, give you lunch, zap out an eye. 2 weeks later, they do the same thing. So it's a food program. The fact is that better technology is generally consistent with more successful results. And if you have something that works better, you generate greater demand. And, of course, although the price might be lower on a per-patient case, you generally generate more spending. And there's no guarantee, by the way, that the price will be lower because of the weird way that we price things, which was certainly actually not all that well explained the last time, but I'm going to claim that it was. Okay, so overuse, underuse, misuse. These are the terms that everybody hears. A great example has to do with treating coronary disease. This is from a paper by Amitabh Chandra and John Skinner. And they classified, actually using another study from somebody else, they classified different kinds of treatments according to their cost effectiveness and their cost. And you can see that the way they did the classification, and I'm sure anybody could have ample reasons to argue one way or another on any specific intervention, but I think the overall sort of pattern here is interesting, that effective low-cost treatments were, according to them, accountable for more than half of the mortality decline due to coronary disease between 1980 and 2000. And, of course, they didn't have the guts to say that anything was actually not cost-effective, but less cost-effective, and probably there wasn't anything that wasn't effective in a sense. And the word cost, I think, is probably an issue here. But you can see that, according to their categorization, the more aggressive treatments, stents, CABGs, cardiac rehab, they're much more expensive than aspirin, for example. That they account for maybe 19% of the mortality decline. Now, you want to be a little careful about this kind of a display because you have to ask yourself something that they didn't ask themselves in the paper, which is, what was the condition of the patient? Somebody who really needed a CABG, you could shove an awful lot of aspirin into their mouth on their way to the morgue. So it's not at all clear. This is in fact a kind of a residual study. It's not very reliable either, but it does say something about our use of services, and it does imply something about the economic incentives associated with the complicated things. Aspirin, who makes money off of that? Not even the drug companies. CABGs, who makes money off of that? You know who they are. That's something to think about. Nonetheless, would you turn this down? Would you go back to Marcus Welby's day where they had heard about infection, but they basically couldn't do much? No, of course not. Because the fact is that we want all of those things. And I'm still sore at Rick because he hasn't given me the drug that's really going to help me, but I'll give you till 2 o'clock. Okay, so what about evidence? You know, can we find out about evidence? Okay, so here's a study from Elliot Fisher looking at regional variations in medical spending. And this is in the this is an index called the End of Life Expenditure Index. So these are Medicare patients at the end of their life. I didn't read the article close enough to know how close to the end of their life they were, but you knew they were, so pretty close. And look at the distribution of tests and procedures that were done on people close to the end of their life. And lo and behold, what do you see? Very few major procedures, quite a few more minor procedures, but a lot of imaging, tests, evaluation, and management. That's where the money is for the very sick people. And obviously, that's where the money is for the not very sick people. It's not in those, I mean, there's plenty of money in those fancy machines. Don't get me wrong. But where is the real throughput? It's in the seemingly ordinary interventions that we're all used to and expect. That's where the money is. Okay. So, well, everybody says, well, let's do some effectiveness research and, you know, figure out what we really should be doing and don't do the things we shouldn't be doing. And the only problem is that there are an awful lot of things that we do, and there are very few studies looking at what we should be doing. And I don't care whether you look at the stimulus funding and you look at the billions of dollars that are going into PCORI and other places. The research can't move fast enough. You can't spend enough money. You'll never get ahead of it, because things that we accept for granted, we do without question. And occasionally, when we question it, such as the on and off again discussion about blood test for prostate disease, we get a lot of resistance, because that's not the way we do it. So, is effectiveness research the way it's going to go? The reason for the iceberg, of course, is that it's probably more than 90% that we're never going to look at. That 10% or whatever the percentage is the small part. It's the glamorous part. And, in fact, it's the part that's already heavily regulated. It tends to be drugs and devices first, everything else last. And that doesn't strike me, looking at the previous chart, as being the exactly intelligent way to allocate resources if you're going to really look at effectiveness research. Even worse, this wasn't supposed to be a diatribe against effectiveness research, but I've always been skeptical. These are highly refined studies and so on, and so it isn't at all clear that they necessarily tell you what would really happen to the average patient in the average setting. And that's a problem, because that's what you really want to know the answer to. Is it going to work most of the time rather than under ideal conditions, or is it not going to work? Because things that would work under ideal conditions might well not work under normal conditions. And, of course, let's not forget about the patient, because the patient might not be adherent either. So, and then finally, there's the moving target. Professional judgment changes all the time. Why is that? Well, partly because there are changes in the way you do things. Partly it's that our experience grows. We see more patients. That experience is accumulated, not necessarily systematically, but it is. And our views, our professional views about what to do, changes all the time. So I think effectiveness research is interesting. It's going to make a lot of people a lot of money. I don't think it's going to have any substantial impact on how we spend the money. So can we actually spend our money better? I think there are some things we can do. Part of the problem is that hardly anybody in this country actually pays for what they get. Yes, they do pay for it. Of course, they pay 100% for it. But they don't know it. They're paying through indirect means. When they go to their doctor can't really tell them how much it's going to cost them, because the doctor doesn't even know what he's going to get paid. It's all a veil, and this brings us back to P and Q. But that's where we have to focus our attention. And we also focus our attention, of course, on better information. But if you don't know the price, you don't know much of anything. And as I said in the previous slide, knowing clinical effectiveness doesn't get you halfway to knowing whether that's something I want. Because what you want to know is value. So there are lots of things we could do. The Medicare program has tried lots of things. They haven't been very successful. They haven't been very successful because it is not a health program. It is a political program, and political programs cannot make decisions. They try, but they can't. I was tied up with the Centers of Excellence project. It was a great project. It worked perfectly, and it was shelved. Coverage with evidence development is another great example. Seemed like a good idea at the time. The hard part wasn't setting it up to phase in coverage for something that may or may not work. The hard part is phasing it out. So what else could you do? Well, conservatives talk an awful lot about financial incentives, and I think this is a case where we do need to apply financial incentives to the whole system. And so I won't get into it, but sensible fee-for-service payment reform in Medicare and premium support could take us a long, long way. Private insurance, I think, is the more likely place where you're going to see action in this, along any of these lines. Why? Because although they do ultimately report to Congress, they don't report directly to Congress. And so there's a possibility of some progress in making hard decisions and trying to make them stick. Now, I've got to say that I haven't seen much evidence of that. But as economic conditions tighten, as business conditions tighten, as the resistance of employers to higher premiums, thereby necessitating to keep premiums not so high, necessitating higher and higher deductibles and copayments, I think we're going to see that begin to turn around, and I think we are beginning to see that turn around among some insurers. One theory that actually Chandra advances is why don't we attach differential copayments to measures of effectiveness? And that sounds like a great idea until you ask yourself, can you really trust those measures of effectiveness? My answer was, no, not really. I think it's too individualistic. But sure, the idea of value-based insurance design is a sound one, and we could, and it's being tried, but it won't be tried in the Medicare program. Providers, professional consensus is actually what drives a lot of things. And so it was great to see this group of specialty societies recently put out under the banner Choosing Wisely, a list of things that they strongly urge their practitioners to reconsider whether they really need to do those things. That's a good idea. New business structures that provide real financial incentives for physicians to rethink their style of practice. That makes a lot of sense if we could find the right kinds of structures. I don't think we've found them yet. And then what about consumers? In the end, what's a consumer? It's a patient. I'm a consumer. And if I could find the right thing for me today, I'd go out there and buy it. And I'd be paying for it with my own money, chances are, and I'd be delighted to do it. What I'd like to know, what I think all consumers would like to know, is not just what is it going to cost me, a question that can barely be answered today, but also how is it likely to affect me? And that's really hard to get an answer to. And that is really the key to understanding how technology works. And then finally, what about expectations? I left that here for consumers because in the end, if we don't change our views about what we demand as an absolute minimum, and Rick, I want to assure you it's complete cure immediately, but until we get realistic about those sorts of things, we will not get control over cost. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Joe. So as Joe said, technology adds to both supply and demand, and one of the things that we know we have an unending supply of right now are patients with chronic disease. So, Ken, over to you to talk about that.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks, Ed and others, for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here on this panel. Great to see everybody that you often don't see all the time. So welcome back to work. I'm having a tough time making the transition myself, so I'm delaying this a little bit. As Susan mentioned, I'm going to talk a little bit about another angle of this, but it's really not unrelated to what Joe's talked about, as you'll see in a minute. It always fascinated me that in healthcare, some of the most fundamental big questions get the least amount of attention and study. So about 6 or 7 years ago, I went back and looked at some of the literature on, you know, what do we know from the published data about what's driving the growth in healthcare spending? And really, the last, you know, one of the last few pieces that I saw was a piece that Joe did. I guess it was 92, 93, Joe Newhouse. Looking at the time period between 1940 to 1990. And if you think about it, you know, that was a very different time period than the most recent experience that we've had. The number of uninsured over that time period went from 90% to 15%. So clearly the amount of induced spending as our whole system changed over time was roughly related to changes in the structure of insurance and demand. And as Joe has just talked about innovation, we brought Medicare and Medicaid on, and there's various estimates about what that contributed to the growth in healthcare spending. We had a whole bunch of really important new innovations that fundamentally trained how we treat patients, neonatal intensive care units and treatment of low birth weight babies, treatment for cardiovascular disease, and so on. So it's a very different time period. And so what I'm going to spend my discussion on is really looking at the time period between the early 1990s and today. And I think the point I'll make is that even during that time period, the year-to-year changes in what's driving the growth in spending is somewhat different. But I really want to look at some of the long-term drivers here that are more recent. And I've sort of taken, you know, you can decompose this into a lot of different ways. I've looked at this and tried to sort the data into sort of three buckets. Looking at the change in spending linked to the change in the prevalence of treated disease. Looking at the change in spending linked to how much we spend to treat a case. and obviously there are interactions between the two of those. And if you look at sort of a long-term component here, let's say the late 80s to today, about 60% of the growth is linked to rising prevalence of treated disease. And we'll go into sort of what accounts for that. Some of that is going to be good, I'll argue. Some of it is going to be bad that we can go in and potentially do something about. So just to give you a sense of some of these, the magnitude of the changes here, and you can go down by medical condition and see the prevalence increases. And for each of these conditions, the factors driving the growth are somewhat different. So if you look at the treatment of cholesterol, mental disorders, those are have obviously increased very dramatically. Much of that is technology related. We have new approaches for treating patients with cholesterol. We have new medical interventions to treat people with mental disorders that we didn't have 30 and 40 years ago. Diabetes, I'll come back to, in a minute and talk about that. That's almost all an incidence increase. That's not really anything that has to do with increased detection. That's largely just more cases of patients with diabetics. This is a particular problem, as we'll see in the Medicare program. It's one of the key drivers of rising spending in Medicare is rising incidence of diabetes and other related cardiovascular diseases. So you can go down the list and see that there really are enormous increases in prevalence of treated disease. So if you take a step back and say, well, what's driving this growth? And some of it, as I mentioned, is going to be things that we, you know, should be happy about. Some of them are going to be things that we shouldn't be happy about. So the first one is, as I mentioned, diabetes. Our detection rates of diabetes really haven't changed much in the last 20 or 30 years. We're today detecting about 72% of total cases of diabetes. That's gone up from the upper 60s 10, 15, 20 years ago. But we're not doing a whole lot better in detecting diabetes. So the treated prevalence numbers we see for that are really just incidence increases, not detection increases. The second one is obviously somewhat, you know, debatable and controversial, but there's no question that over time we changed the definition of disease. So we've had a change in clinical thresholds for treating different types of conditions, particularly cardiovascular disease. I think that most of the studies that I've seen that have looked at that think that that's a good thing, that a more aggressive treatment of cardiovascular risk factors has been a leading cause of declining rates of cardiovascular mortality over the last 20 years. New medical technologies, obviously the treatment of mental disorders, and Joe went through that, provide more tools for us to treat patients that we didn't have 30 or 40 years ago. We're living longer, so you're going to see some increases in the disease prevalence linked to longevity, and changing definitions of disease. So if you look at the definition of just something as simple as diabetes, that's changed a little bit over time in terms of the clinical blood sugar levels that kick off a diagnosis of diabetes versus prediabetes. Well, this issue, one of the things that's very different in this time period that we're looking at is increases in obesity. If you look at the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, that whole time period, the share of adults considered obese was about 17%. Really didn't change for about 30 years, so clearly not a contributor over the time period that Joe was looking at to rising health care costs. It was just not changed. It was a constant. Well, that's not the case most recently. So if you look at the long-term trends here, and hopefully we're stabilizing it a little bit, it's doubled since the mid-1980s. And if you look at some of the, you know, calculations that are just linking or looking at how much of the growth in spending is due solely to obesity holding technology constant and holding treatment intensity constant, depending on the time period you want to look at, it accounts for about 7 to 10% of the rise in spending. CBOs did an estimate of it, and they came up with 8%. So it's of all the things that we can actually quantify, to Joe's point, we can't quantify the technology piece, but of the things that we can try to quantify, it is an important contributor. If you look at Medicare spending, About a third of the growth in Medicare spending over the last decade is linked to sort of cardiovascular risk conditions that are in part lifestyle related, diabetes, arthritis, kidney disease, hypertension, and mental disorders. The thing that's kind of interesting about those particular conditions in the Medicare program is that those are largely conditions that are ambulatory treated with appropriate medication. Unless you botch it up somehow, with the exception of kidney disease, you really have nothing to do with inpatient hospitals here. This is really issues dealing with ambulatory care, primary care, medication management. And the ultimate irony of that is that traditional fee-for-service Medicare is really the only major payer, unless you're homebound, that has no care coordination. So it just doesn't do it. We'll tell you you've got a problem in your personalized care plan, but we don't have anything available to really engage patients in Medicare to help them manage these conditions. We've done some tabulations that kind of try to sort these out in terms of spending increases over time. And as I've mentioned, the share of spending increase linked to disease prevalence versus cost per case does differ over the time period that you're looking at. The most recent couple of years, obviously, we're in an economic slowdown, and so we have slower rates of utilization. And over the last couple of years, spending per treated case is a more important explanation of rising healthcare spending. But if you go back and look at these long-term trends, it really is disease prevalence increases that are driving it. But if you try to drill down a little bit more in this and say, well, if we can look at treatment intensity, meaning how much are we spending to treat a particular case of diabetes or heart disease over time, and how much of it is just due to increases in obesity, again, holding technology constant. As I mentioned, about 7 to 9% is due to obesity alone. And if you look at the 1987 to 2001 time period, about a quarter of the growth in spending is due to increases in the intensity of treatment, of how we're engaging and working with patients. Now, some of that is due to changes in technology, clinical thresholds for treatment, clinical recommendations for how aggressive we should be treating patients. They're all bottled up into the same bucket here. But treatment intensity is a major a component of this as well. And if you look at both obesity and treatment intensity, anywhere from 20 to 30% of the growth is linked to both of those two combined. So what are some of the challenges here that we face? We know that any given year that obese adults spend about 40% more in health care. And depending on, there's a whole range of different estimates of how much is in the base of spending linked to obesity. And I think the last piece I saw was something around 20-21%. Is due to obesity alone in the base of healthcare spending. Obviously, as a productivity component, we spend a lot of time focusing on the healthcare piece, but if you look at the total cost of chronic healthcare conditions, for every buck that we spend on the medical side, we're losing about $4 in productivity. So there's a bigger component to this that's really important. Let me go back to my Medicare challenge here. In the Medicare program, if you look at age 65 and look at lifetime health care expenditures starting at age 65, and if you compare the lifetime spending of an obese adult versus a normal weight adult, and there's a couple of good models out there that have put this, done these estimates, anywhere from 20 to 40% more spending over the course of the lifetime for an obese adult at age 65 in Medicare. So the point is that this is a very different story than smoking. Smoking is a mortality discussion. This is a morbidity discussion, that there's not really that huge differential mortality rates linked to obesity. So it seems to me, if you think about Medicare, there's two opportunities that I think that are important. One is to find ways to change the incoming health profile of people coming into the program, because there are long-term potential savings associated with having a healthier population coming in at age 65. And let's just go back to the care coordination piece. And I'm sure Melanie will talk about this, and they're doing a great job of trying to build more care coordination and to dual eligibles. But if you think about the opportunities here to put into place evidence-based care coordination interventions, I think in programs like Medicare, they're enormous. Over the next decade, Medicare is going to spend roughly $500 to $600 billion on readmissions that we could potentially prevent. So that begs the question of why don't we build something into the program that's actually effective in doing this? And the frustration is that we actually have interventions that are effective. So we have a program that Eric Coleman has developed some time ago out of the University of Colorado, Denver, that has several randomized trials that shows that we can cut readmission rates by 50 to 60%. We have a more intensive advanced practice nurse model that Mary Naylor at Penn has developed that comes up with very similar results. That should just be a major component built into fee-for-service Medicare that would accompany this broader wellness package that we built in. So I think that there's opportunities here, but we've got to focus on, I think, two of the problems that we can actually do something about. You know, one is preventing and averting disease in the first place, and I'd love to have a discussion about some of those opportunities through things like the diabetes prevention program that I've written on. And second is to really build into programs like Medicare evidence-based components of care coordination that we basically have decades worth of randomized trials that show that they work. Things like transitional care, medication therapy management, health coaching, having an integrated care coordination model into the primary care practice. So we know the elements that are effective. I think that we just need to find ways to integrate them and build them into Medicare. So with that, I'll keep this short, and I really look forward to the discussion.
Great. Well, thanks to both of you. So we now have some time for clarifying questions. If people want to ask questions specifically of Ken or Joe to draw them out on points they made, we don't want to get into a lot of deep analysis of what they said at this point or debate, but just, again, clarifying questions. If you do have a question, please introduce yourself briefly by name and affiliation, and be sure to switch on your mic. So let me take a quick look around. If not, let me ask, I'll take the moderator's prerogative then to ask one to you, Joe. If I look at your slide that was labeled High Cost of Advancing Technology, this is the one where you label X-ray machine, right, et cetera, and I look at current technology, I see two items mentioned there, surgery robot and treated stent, both of which recent studies have shown do not materially produce better outcomes for patients. And in fact, with respect to the treated stents, I think Johnson & Johnson's unit stopped making them because they were clearly not just ineffective but problematic for patients. That underscores that we have a lot of technology out there that either does not produce better outcomes but yet costs a lot more or, in fact, can be harmful. And, of course, more broadly, the Institute of Medicine tells us about half of all of the medical interventions we engage in, there's no evidence that they work at all. So I was curious as to why you didn't put even more emphasis on some aspects of technology assessment as being potentially a more actionable solution.
Well, I think since everybody believes that, I wanted to make the somewhat counterpoint. I'm not completely disagreeing with it, but the somewhat counterpoint that what we're going to focus on is, in fact, the treated stent and actually less so the surgery robot, since that's such a great marketing tool for big hospitals. And people want to believe that somehow putting a machine between the surgeon and their body is necessarily an improvement. They really would like an improvement there because they think they could be seriously harmed or killed. The fact is that we do have a tendency, especially on stents, for example, smaller things, we do have a tendency to look at those. For one reason, it's easier to examine the effect of a stent because it has a purpose. It doesn't have multiple purposes. It is less dependent on the skill of the physician to place it, for example. There's some skill involved, but it's a somewhat more singular product. that is more amenable to testing. And that, I think, is maybe the point I'm trying to make, that we have a tendency to examine the things that are easy to examine and not the things that are really hard to figure out. The hardest things to figure out are the things that are standard practice. There's some hope for technology assessment. In my view, there isn't much hope in going from good technology assessment to sound Medicare policy, but there could be plenty of hope going from good technology assessment to good professional standards.
Okay. And Ken, a quick question for you. You have used the phrase treated prevalence here a lot, suggesting that you're distinguishing between just prevalence and treated prevalence. Obviously, we actually treat people. Can you disaggregate those two pieces? I mean, how much of, for example, it's potentially possible. We're giving statins to a lot of people now for high cholesterol, and there's a lot of debate about whether that is even the correct set of interventions. So how much of this is treatment independent of actual prevalence versus treated prevalence?
Boy, now I'm confused.
Jeez.
It's not even happy hour. So,
are you sensitive about these heart issues?
Well, the phrase for me, treatment, treated prevalence, is to distinguish the fact that we really are only engaging a fraction of patients that have different conditions. So if we go back to my diabetes example, 28% of people that live with diabetes have not been diagnosed and don't have a medical intervention. So at some point, hopefully they will, but at any point in time, they're not. So that's the distinction. The other part of it is an important issue. I tried to distinguish in this in the discussion that there are components of prevalence that we could intervene and do something about, and we want to. So issues around obesity and lifestyle and diet and exercise and things like diabetes that we can reverse the curve on. There are other components of this where, if you go back to my slide and look at the treatment of cholesterol and hypertension, that are a medical call that says, you know, if we are more aggressive at treating those diseases, plus we have the new technologies to do it, that it does produce better value, that we're reducing cardiovascular mortality, that we're improving the quality of life, and so on. So I think that some of the stuff that David Cutler and others have done looking at the impact that antihypertensives and cholesterol interventions have had are good investments. But, you know, those are also part of the discussion here, is that we have changed and made medical decisions and treatment decisions that say if we're more aggressive at treating certain types of cardiovascular risk factors, that they do pay off.
Okay. Yes, Brad.
Brad Stewart, Sutter Health, Northern California, where we're building systems of care coordination for seniors. My question to you is, I'm a primary care doc for a third of a century in research as well. All of our discussion, and I'm coming from a provider place, is focused on the providers. What about preference of patients, particularly seniors who are in this Dartmouth Atlas near end of life population, where our data is showing now that they would prefer not to be patients. They would like to be comfortable and stable and safe at home. And I think we have systems to begin to do that. But my question around the data is, we have a lot of studies now on effectiveness. In other words, is the treatment necessary and valuable? What kind of data do we have on preference, where we begin to know whether these treatments are actually wanted or unwanted, which to me is much less controversial than trying to decide what's necessary? You often can't know what's necessary until after you do it and it hasn't worked. It's not controversial to know that people really don't want this stuff, and as it turns out, many of them don't.
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, as I think about some these different models of primary care and care coordination, and to your point about, let's just take palliative care, and giving people options and decisions about the type of care, how aggressive they want care to be toward the end of their life, and Lord knows I don't want to bring up death panels, but, you know, that's a legitimate discussion that needs to be built into the coding of Medicare. It needs to be part and parcel of how families and patients and healthcare providers talk about options. And, you know, I think that that's a classic example of working with patients to give them options and give them information and have the time to be able to have the time to actually, from a physician standpoint, to talk about that is important. And we're, you know, I'm seeing more and more interesting palliative care models come into place. Hospice, you know, again, is another important component of that. But, you know, having the time to have that discussion in a fee-for-service system is a real problem. I mean, it's just not built into the coding. It's not built into the amount of time that physicians get to spend on counseling with patients on important decisions like that, and it should be built into how we think about doing care coordination and primary care with patients to give them options and then have the options out there available. And let me just give you another example on the other side of this. Is if you think about, to me, sort of the incompleteness of the Medicare wellness benefit, you know, we built in a welcome to Medicare physical. We're going to do a health risk appraisal. We're going to give you a personalized care plan that says you're overweight and pre-diabetic, but we don't cover anything to do anything about it. Right? So, I mean, if you think about it, and there are programs out there like the Diabetes Prevention Program that the WISE and United Health Group have put into place that we've shown in randomized trials, including community-based randomized trials, that they generate a 5 to 7% weight loss. Well, that should be an option that's built in to the Medicare program that would give people a choice of, geez, if I really want to make a difference in terms of changing, you know, lifestyle or improving my blood sugar levels, that should be a component of what Medicare covers. So on both extremes, we don't give people a whole lot of options because of the way that the Medicare coverage policy works.
Let's see, Rick Smith.
Hi, Rick Smith with Pharma. Question for Ken. Ken, you have referenced several initiatives around the cluster of chronic conditions that you identified as significant cost drivers. Can you speak a little bit to what happens to utilization and outcomes as these interventions take place? And, you know, how does care change and what does that ultimately add up to in terms of outcomes, cost, and so forth?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, you can look at the prevalence data in terms of, you know, how we're treating patients with cardiovascular risk factors, and then the more important question is what are we getting from it? Is it worth it? And, you know, I referenced David's work on this and others that I think that on balance that the more aggressive treatment of patients with cardiovascular disease is worth it, that we're getting improvements in longevity, we're getting improvements in the quality of life, that those are investments that not only are clinically driven, but are generating better outcomes. So that those are, as I was sort of parsing my prevalence increases into the two components, things that are good increases, things that we want to, you know, make investments in and should be happy about, that would be a series of them that we've done on statins and cholesterol. And then there's a series of prevalence increases that are bad that we should try to do something to reduce. Our incident increases linked to lifestyle and diet and exercise and smoking and so on, like diabetes. So they're different issues, and how we think about them, I think, are very different.
See, Tom Miller, and is there a hand up there? Yeah, Mariella. We'll come back to Mariella.
Tom Miller, AEI. Ken, we've gotten quite good and clever at coming up with new names to call chronic conditions. Got a code. We can find a technology and a bill to throw at it. You have a list of the ones that have had greater treated prevalence. When you do your time series, what have we had any reduction in terms of treated prevalence? What's gone off the list? I know we made great savings on smallpox, I'm sure. But beyond that, is it only an additive key to the keyboard?
No, that's a good question. And we've broken these into, I guess we have 260 that we've looked at. And I'd say most of them are fairly constant. I mean, obviously the big ones like heart disease and cancer, we're getting improvements in. The one that has been the biggest decline, which actually adds to a lot of the cost, is trauma. So the prevalence of trauma cases has gone down fairly substantially. So that's a big reduction. But most of these have seen, you know, fairly substantial increases over time, and a lot of it is, as I've mentioned, has been obesity related, and a lot of them are related to these cardiovascular risk factors. And I think that kind of the interesting thing is that if you look at the spending growth in the United States going back to the 40s or 50s, I mean, it's not that it's a whole lot different. It's been at 2.5 percentage points above GDP. I think that the factors generating those increases over time have changed, and obviously we're not out of whack internationally either, but you know, we have seen some differences in what's generating that delta. So if you look at a Medicare patient in 1965 versus today, they're very different. I mean, the clinical profile is different of the patients. You know, the typical patient driving spending in Medicare today is a overweight 70-year-old that's a hypertensive diabetic with bad cholesterol, asthma, back problems, pulmonary disease, and is depressed. That's the patient, and the problem is that those are all conditions that really require behavior change, engagement, appropriate ambulatory care, medication therapy management, nothing that Medicare does.
Let me add something, though. This is a pitch for technology. One of the reasons we have more treated prevalence on nearly everything is it's easier to treat. It's also, there's the push for so-called prevention, which means earlier a diagnosis. So it's a little hard to know where all these fit in, but I really do think that the march of medical progress has contributed considerably to this trend.
So Mariella Payne, and then I think Dan Callahan has a hand up as well.
So should we be thinking, though, more about targeting hotspots or targeting populations or targeting industries? A lot of what we generally talk about is broad policy changes in Medicare and other areas, but certainly the obesity and other risk factors seem to be located in certain parts of the U.S., I would argue. Should we start to focus on those areas and maybe not have across-the-board sort of improvements, but in order to get, you know, given limited resources, to think about that a little bit more?
Well, that's a good question. I'll give you my pitch on the diabetes prevention program. So we have a population of 80 million people nationally that are pre-diabetic. We have a program that we know through 10 years of clinical trial follow-ups that has a cumulative reduction in the incidence of diabetes of 34%. So it works at a point in time, and we have a 10-year follow-up study that shows that over time we can reduce it. United Health Group and the YMCAs have put these into place now in 25 states. We can reduce weight by 5 to 7%. We can reduce the incidence of diabetes in a short period of time by 58%, and for older populations, 71%. That program could be scaled nationally in the next 12 to 18 months for $80 million. Not B, M. Why in the world don't we do that out of the public health fund? That's just something that is an investment that we should do. We should build that one simple program in nationally, have it available so that small employers could use it, Medicare patients could be referred to it, and exchanges, plans in the exchange could refer patients to this. You know, that's a simple example of something that we should just be doing because we know it works. I guess my point of saying that is that we have a whole variety of interventions that would target these problems that I've talked about, that we have years of data to show that they work. Transitional care models, diabetes prevention program. We need to flip the switch here and get into implementation mode not pilot project mode. We're not going to pilot project ourselves into a solution here. I mean, we need to sort of take things that we know that work, target them to at-risk populations, and we can make an enormous difference.
No, that was my point. It's not doing more pilots, about trying, though, to get those package of services you know that works to the people who are at the highest risk in certain parts of the country. But
that'd be great. I mean, I live in the obesity triangle. So, I mean, if you just take the CDC data on obesity rates over time and looking at changes in diabetes prevalence, they're interchangeable charts. They're basically the same charts. And so, you know, we have things that we can do right now that would make a difference. And, you know, we just need, like I said, to flip the switch and focus on implementation. And you can tell from my what I'm saying is I have complete pilot fatigue. Sure, we need more information and we need to pilot some other different projects, but we have so much data on programs that we already know that work that we should just, you know, we should just implement and build into how we do business in the exchanges. If you think about on the exchange side, something that we're not really talking about is that in the definition of essential health benefits, we have inpatient, outpatient, the usual services, but also a component of certification for plans to be in exchanges, prevention and care coordination. Well, what do we mean by that? What are we certifying and asking plans to do in the exchanges on prevention and care coordination? Well, geez, there's some really simple things that would make a lot of sense that we would hope plans would do, like transitional care models and evidence-based lifestyle programs like the DPP.
All right, Dan Callahan, and then we'll move on to our reactor panel.
I'd just like to raise one issue that has not been touched on, and that is how do we – I'll take Ken's example of the 70-year-old with all the things wrong. We talk a lot about coordinating care. The question is, how do you assess care with multi-organ failure or multi-diseases at the same time? We're very good at doing it with individual cases, but if you get a team of physicians together and you're trying to coordinate them, how do they – assess the overall work and their interaction?
I'll put my MD hat on for a minute. I think that this is a great example of why having team-based care, and if you look at some of the health systems that do, I think, a pretty good job of that, whether it's, you know, Marshfield Clinic or Geisinger, you know, where you really are building teams to deal with multiple problems and you're really treating patients as, you know, holistically, is probably the best way to go with this. If you think about, you know, let's take Medicaid, good example. Even in Medicaid, when we do care coordination, a lot of the care coordination still segments off care coordination into different buckets. You know, you'll have behavioral health care contracted out. You'll have pharmacy contracted out. You'll have acute care. You know, dealing with a patient that has all of those problems. So even coordinated care sometimes in Medicaid is not coordinated at all. It's really still fractured. So to the extent that you know, continue to drive this towards payment reforms that really move us towards team-based care, that really engage patients for the whole range of medical problems is probably, I think, our best bet. It's certainly not fee-for-service Medicare. That's not how that program works at all.
Thank you. We're now going to move on to a series of short presentations from our reactor panel. These are non-nuclear reactors, but they are nonetheless very energized. We'll get through their presentations, I know, energetically, so we have time for a break and then a beefy amount of time for a discussion. We're going to start with Melanie Bella from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who is leading those efforts at care coordination for the dual eligible population. Melanie?
Good morning. Thank you, Ed and others, for inviting me to be here today. I was trying to figure out exactly why I was invited, and then it sort of hit me in the face in a very obvious way, which is I think dual eligibles are the poster children for high users of technology and high cost. And Bruce and Diane and others, I think, will get into some of the statistics around the prevalence of chronic disease. but the fragmentation between the two programs just exacerbates the use of technology and the high costs that are driving the system. And so I just want to spend a couple of minutes kind of on that theme of what is actionable and talk about a couple of actionable things that we're trying to do at CMS to try to get a handle of the opportunity to improve quality and costs for this population. And the first is all about data. Until we understand better this population, the subsets of the population, what's driving their care needs, what the utilization patterns are, by very discrete subpopulations, we're not going to be as effective as we can be in developing new models to improve care coordination, to improve transitions, to improve the use of long-term care services. And so there's a few things we're doing in that regard. One is I'm pleased to say that CMS now has an integrated data set, so Medicaid and Medicare at the person level. It's not 2011, unfortunately, but we're getting there over time, and it's really going to help drive our analysis as well as those of others in the room and other interested stakeholders. The second is we'll soon be releasing state profiles. So it'll be a state-by-state look at the demographics, the utilization, the costs, again, from an integrated data set perspective of the individuals who are duly eligible in that state. It's not meant to compare state to state because we're not controlling for the differences in the Medicaid program, but again, it'll be a useful tool to get out there. Another thing we're doing that I think is very relevant to this discussion is looking at the simplest way to call it is a pathway analysis. So it's very different if you start on Medicaid and age into Medicare versus if you start on Medicare and have some sort of functional and financial decline that makes you Medicaid eligible. And the types of care coordination models or whether someone would be whose care would be improved by care transitions, I mean, all of those things highly dependent on what drove a person to be in the program, what their care needs are, who they trust to get information about those care needs, all very different depending on which M you start with. And so we're doing a lot of work in that area. And then lastly, I'd say, and those of you who are researchers hopefully will appreciate, we're making significant enhancements to the CMS chronic condition warehouse so that we now have conditions for diagnoses for serious mental illness, for alcohol use, for intellectual and developmental disabilities. And if we, again, are going to truly understand the prevalence of chronic disease for this population by subpopulations, we have to continue to add to those, to the diagnoses that are in the CCW, particularly those that are going to reflect things that Medicare maybe hasn't looked at so much as Medicaid has in the past. And so that's a critical part of the effort. As part of our efforts to work with states in this arena, we've been focused on making sure states have access to Medicare data for care coordination purposes. So we have tried to streamline a process that, while abiding by all privacy and confidentiality rules, allows states access to these data. We have 22 states that have either received or in the process of receiving Parts A and B, and 20 states who have received or in the process of receiving Part D. And when I talk a little bit about demonstrations, from our perspective, it's critical that states are requesting these data to show us that they have an understanding of their population and they can tailor their interventions and their demonstrations to the needs of those populations and their very heterogeneous care pathways. So the next thing I would just mention quickly, along, again, the theme of actionable, are demonstrations. And I appreciate Ken's comments about, I think, pilot fatigue. We're getting all sorts of feedback on our demonstrations. One is they're too big and we're moving too fast. And then we have others telling us, boy, you know, it's about time. And can't you go a little bit quicker? And so I would say that certainly I understand the pilot fatigue. I think for this population, we have not yet tested. There is no evidence base for truly integrated, improved, coordinated care, particularly that bridges the behavioral health, the long-term services and supports, and the acute and primary. However, there are important components, the Naylor and Coleman models, the diabetes prevention. We expect to see those things where they would are relevant for those populations in the demonstrations. We have a state-based demonstration opportunity right now, and that involves two models. One is a capitated model. One is a managed fee-for-service model. We have 26 states interested in pursuing one or both of those models at this point. Some states targeting a 2013 implementation date and others targeting a 2014 implementation date. I do want to emphasize we expect to see care models and care teams and care plans that are tailored to the different needs of the populations And we've not done as good a job of that in the past as we need to. You know, the needs of someone who is kind of the prototypical 80-year-old Medicare patient that Ken described are very different than someone under 65 whose needs are primarily long-term care-driven, or someone who's in an institution. And so understanding, again, all these varieties is a great opportunity for us to test in these new situations. And then I'm very excited. The other demonstration that we're doing is for dual-eligible beneficiaries who are in nursing facilities. There are about 1 million of them at any given time. Potentially avoidable hospitalizations is a critical opportunity for improvement here. The churn between hospital and nursing home, largely driven by the misaligned financing of the two programs, is actionable improvement in both quality and cost. A CMS study showed that 26% of hospitalizations for duals were potentially avoidable. In today's dollars, that's about $8 billion. And it's just very poor care for patients, obviously. So we have a demonstration going on targeted at beneficiaries in nursing homes, and we're very excited about that. So in closing, I would just say I couldn't be a bigger fan of trying to develop evidence-based models of care coordination and also looking at prevention. An area that we have not yet been able to focus on are the pre-duals. So that the folks who are 45 to 64, before they're coming on to Medicare, there's a huge opportunity for us to do care coordination or medical homes or care management to improve their utilization and the prevalence and the intensity of the disease when they get on Medicare. And then the folks who are on Medicare, there's a lot we could be doing to prevent their decline onto Medicaid. And so far, the financing and the incentives between the two programs haven't supported that work. And I'm hopeful that once we kind of get through dealing with the 9 million folks who are on the program, we can really shift attention to the pre-duals and doing a much better job of managing, I'd say, the progression of folks to dual eligibility status. So with that, I will close and just say thank you again for being part of the panel.
Great. Thanks very much, Melanie. We're going to turn now to Joe Newhouse. Joe, it's often asserted that the U.S. is an outlier in health spending. How big an outlier are we, really, if we are?
Thanks, Susan. This discussion somewhat reminds me of Rashomon. How many of you have seen that movie? Not many. So it's a classic Japanese movie and basically presents four different views of the same reality. And I think that's some of what we're hearing here. Now, I noticed in the green book that you were handed when you walked in, there's the usual slide, which I'm not going to show you, on page 7 of the U.S. spends a lot more than everybody else, which Susan alluded to. What's less well appreciated, although Ken mentioned it in passing, in my first slide, is that... How do I advance the slides? What I've done here is look at annual growth rates per person in real health care spending over time. So this is almost 50 years. And the asterisks are by these are the G7, by Germany, Italy, and Japan, because there's strange things about their numbers, not just that they're different. Germany had reunification in this period. Italy actually doesn't start until 1988 in the OECD data, and most of that Japanese bulge is in the 1960s when their economy was growing 11% a year. But if I look at the other four, the U.S. actually is the highest, but not by a lot, certainly not by nothing like the levels. And then I'd like to go on and say when Corey Uccello and I just participated in the Medicare Trustees 75-year review, which you may think is a waste of time, but we were doing our civic duty. And in projecting 75 years, or even 10 for that matter, it's really the growth rates that matter. It's the growth rates that are doing it to federal, state, and personal budgets. I just did a calculation over the weekend of the Kaiser data on average family premium against median income. 2009 to 2010, that went from 22% to 28%. So the average family premium, that's total cost, that's not out of pocket. So the family premium is now for the average family insurance policy 28% of median income, which is, I find, a somewhat staggering number. So the inference I draw from that is that the rate of cost growth is going to slow down. I can't tell you how, but it is. Nothing grows to the sky, as the saying in financial markets, and it's true here. So the U.S. and the other countries are also not so different, at least the U.K., France, and Canada. Here are the data by time. Ken alluded to these two. I've just arbitrarily broken things into decades since the 40s. And what you see is you see some variation around that average. But there's usually something happened in those decades that departed a lot from the average. Medicare, Medicaid, the managed care introduction in the 90s, the recession in the last decade. But what's remarkable to me, and the reason I put this up, is to give you some perspective that this issue of cost growth is A, common across countries, and B, has been going on for a very long time. So what I take from that is that while the U.S. certainly spends a lot more than everybody else, that must be something that's U.S. specific. But the growth issue must be something that's common to countries and to decades. Now, I take Ken's point that things may have changed over time in terms of what's driving this, but I still think it's important to keep in mind that this is not – whatever is happening here is not necessarily a result of things that are specific to the U.S., which we naturally tend to get wrapped up in. The second point I wanted to make, which has also been alluded to, is we've actually gotten something out of all of this growth in spending. You know, again, the usual line is we spend a lot more than everybody else and we trail in life expectancy. But if I look at the change in spending against the change in life expectancy, never mind morbidity, things like cataracts and hip replacements, this is a remarkable change just since 1970, which, looking around the room, most of us are old enough to remember. You know, my students can't tell the difference between 1970 and 1870, but I can certainly tell the difference. So what's quite remarkable is that life expectancy is, like a lot of other things, subject to diminishing returns. That is, it gets harder and harder to get an increment. And we grew 7 years, which is a major achievement, in my mind, as did other countries. So, again, this is going on everywhere. Now, one can say how much of this is attributable to medical care. Well, this is kind of a busy slide as it's projected up there. This is a graph from a study of several trials. It's in your handout. And in or epidemiologic studies, I'm sorry, about what accounted for the change in coronary heart disease. And the darker bar on the left is what these authors attributed to treatment. These are in various countries, not just the U.S. And the lighter bar is how much they attributed to what are called risk factors, but the risk factor part includes the better control of hypertension and better control of cholesterol, as well as the fall in smoking, which are the three big things in the light part there. But the dark part is the higher tech treatments. It's the decline in coronary heart disease. It's almost all of the decline in life, the gain in life expectancy in these years. So we actually did get something for all of this. Now, that said, I think the, you know, what Joe and Ken have put forward about what to do makes a great deal of sense. And what Melanie has said makes a great deal of sense. But I would leave you with the notion that this is a very pervasive and longstanding issue about cost. Something is going to make it slow down because it cannot continue at historical rates. But how that will happen, I am not wise enough to know.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Joe. We're going to move now to Jim Pasulis of the American College of Cardiology. And, Jim, this is your chance to explain to us why all of this spending on cardiovascular disease interventions has been entirely worth it.
I hope so. I want to thank Ed, and I want to thank Mariella, because you're probably as much responsible for me being here as anybody else. But I don't know if that's good, Mariella, until after the comments, okay? I guess we've picked cardiovascular disease as the example or the model of chronic disease here. Let me just say that I would also going to go into that a little bit, but go into the data and take the opportunity to say what a disease-specific association can do that's actionable in what we've been talking about. Right off the bat, one thing we haven't talked about, cardiovascular disease also has an effect on the economy, a net loss to productivity of anywhere from $300 to $400 billion a year in lost productivity. Also, though, Dr. Newhouse's slides, the last decade we've had a 30% reduction in mortality from cardiovascular disease, probably from the treatment. And I'm going to just say in the data aspects, we have to kind of be careful what we pick, what population we looked at, because one slide looked at stenting versus medical maximal management. And that really is in the elective case. We're not talking about doing stents in the acute MI case. That's well proven to be very effective. And a little bit about the stents, whether the drug-eluting or bare metal, if you want to look at outcome as mortality, there's probably not a big difference. If you want to look at outcome as whether you need to have another procedure, then there is a difference. So what I'm getting at is the data. And getting the data also to the physicians is very important. And one of the things we've done over the last 35 years is to develop guidelines that look at the science and try to translate that science into what you should be doing. And more recently, actually taking those guidelines and develop what's called appropriate use criteria, and we use those appropriate use criteria in our five recommendations in the Choosing Wisely, which has already been mentioned. And with those appropriate use criteria, you can actually set up some continuous quality improvement aspects with the physician. And by giving the physician their data on what they're actually doing and what they see, how they're doing against the norms, and whether they're using the procedures, the investigations, the imaging appropriately, and you can actually get them to improve their care. We found that just giving a dashboard of how the physician ranks against their fellows in their practice in the community and the region and nationally, as far as where they score, for instance, on nuclear studies for their appropriate use criteria, will decrease their use about 15 to 20%, getting down into the range that we think that should be about 8% of what we would label as inappropriate use. Now, of course, you can't tell a physician not to do something because it's still, I think it's been mentioned, it's medicine's still an art as much as it is science. But practicing the best science that you can, getting the data to the physician so they can make a better decision. Part of that also with the appropriate use criteria and choosing wisely is also the interaction with the patient, getting them to understand, and it's already been mentioned, the shared decision making, where you're discussing with them ahead of time the options. So take coronary artery disease in an elective situation. You can have maximal medical management. You could have CABG or coronary artery bypass, or you could have a stent placed. And giving the a tool for the physician to look and see which is the best that this patient fits in, and then see what the patient wants as well, and helping make that decision. So I think that's how we've been looking at how do we decrease the curve. Now, I would say that actually we've discussed the cholesterol and management of coronary artery risk disease risk factors, and mentioned California. We've looked at the data on both coronary artery bypass and stenting for coronary artery disease, and it's gone down all the last 5 years in California. And if you look at the CMS data, there's been a 10% reduction from last year, or actually the year before to last year, for both CABGs and stenting, and actually reduction also in imaging and cardiac imaging. And I think that's actually speaks towards the addressing of the risk factors. I'm glad everyone's looking at obesity, and Mariella knows that I worked on obesity when I was in practice in Arkansas. It gets to be quite hard. We were actually on the commission that set up measuring the BMI on the kids at the school, and you can imagine when how to do it so no one else knew the BMI and sending it home and things. But we had a 33% prevalence of obesity in the school-age kids, and by doing the measurements, taking the vending machines out of school, et cetera, we at least leveled that. Now, we didn't impact the 48% smoking prevalence, or tobacco use. I guess it was much dipping as it was smoking. The other thing is that when you do action on data, and one program I'll mention is the door to balloon, which means from when a patient with an acute MI hits the ER, the door to the ER, until they're actually blowing up the balloon in the artery to open up the vessel. We know that if you do that under 90 minutes, you save heart muscle, and as a result, you don't have as much congestive heart failure, so you decrease the morbidity, the subsequent morbidity. We went from about a 50%, 60% in the ERs to about 90% of all ERs hitting that, and hospitals hitting that number. And that probably saves 2 to 3 days of hospitalization, and also puts the patient back to work after 3 to 5 days, as opposed to what we mentioned when Eisenhower had his heart attack and was admitted to Fitzsimmons Army Hospital. He sat in the hospital with a little heparin, a little morphine, and a lot of prayer, and they actually have his immortalized bedpan in the room there. But we won't go into that either. They have a little room for where he was at the hospital there now. But where did the savings go? The cardiologist didn't get paid anymore. So here's a program that actually had savings, and we still haven't figured out whether they were bought. The hospital got them through the DRG, or the insurer got them. So I think whatever we do with these models, we have to look at, like Joe said, is there has to be some incentives built in, so that if you're doing this extra stuff, we're paying for this data. And finally, the other thing we have are the registries that we can actually track the outcomes. Maybe when the electronic health record gets to where it should be, we can do it that way. But data, disease-specific, procedure-specific outcomes over longitudinal time, and that really tells us, someone mentioned in the trials, they tend to be, like most of us up here, middle-aged, bald, white males. Not all of us, but we are the obviously the trial, the people in the trial, and we don't reflect the makeup of society. But with a registry, you see actually what we're doing and how we're treating. So data specific, give the data to the physician so the physician can act on it, and then I would echo what they said: greater physician and patient interaction and shared decision making.
Great, thank you, Jim. So, Diane Rowland, in your capacity both at Kaiser Family Foundation as well as at MACPAC, you've done a lot of thinking about these high-cost patients and some of the challenges to delivering coordinated care and improving health outcomes and lowering the cost. So tell us about that thinking.
Thank you, Susan. I think I can just do it with this, right? This arrow? Well, I always come to these forums, and we talk a lot about the Medicare program, and sometimes we talk about private insurance, and we don't always, when we talk about healthcare costs, bring the Medicaid program into perspective. So I just wanted to remind us about why Medicaid takes care of a lot of people with chronic illness and why it spends a lot of its resources on that population. And, of course, this is our most classic slide showing that one in four beneficiaries on the Medicaid program are disabled and elderly, but they account for two-thirds of the spending. And a large reason for that, of course, is that there is a lot of long-term care expenditure on behalf of those populations. But let's focus for just 1 minute on that under 65 disability population for Medicaid. And we like to talk these days a lot, as Melanie mentioned, about the dual eligible population. But there are 9 million people with disabilities on Medicaid who are not elderly. And most of those people are actually not dual eligibles. Only 2 million of them are dual eligibles. So one of the real challenges in the program, and Ken alluded to it, is to get better coordinated care, better services to the disability population for which Medicaid has whole responsibility and where it does have a range of services. Care coordination, case management are actually part of the Medicaid benefit package and could be much more effectively used on that population with disabilities. And this is a slide that, of course, we're used to seeing in every part of our healthcare system. There's only a few people who account for the majority of any spending. And in Medicaid, the top 5% really account for a substantial share of that spending, and the few people there that are children and adults are relatively small, though they are high cost. It really there is largely driven by the disability population. And when we think about the disabled on Medicaid, we have to remember that they include a substantial share of the population with severe mental illness. And it's often when you look at who is a high-cost beneficiary, it's the combination of one or another of the disabling conditions combined with mental illness. And so a diabetic, I think Ken and others have looked at this, someone with diabetes who's being treated with a mental illness is much higher cost and much less likely to follow the treatment protocols than someone who is just a diabetic. So that is a real challenge, and especially, as Ken even alluded to, much of the Medicaid care coordination through managed care carves out mental health and manages it totally separately, and now much of the drug cost is also carved out in many places so that you really don't have the integration for that disability population that could help. But we are focused increasingly, increasingly today on the share of Medicaid spending that goes for the dual eligible population. And as you see from this slide, there are about 15% of total Medicaid enrollment are people who have both Medicaid and Medicare coverage, and they account for 38% of overall spending. And a huge part of that is long-term care services. But I'd like to point out that really if you're trying to manage that low-income disabled population, there's another 10% of the Medicaid population that are disabled and a few non-Medicare eligible aged that account for another 28% of spending. So I would say within the Medicaid program, we really need to look at how to really better manage. And actually, there's an ability in Medicaid to do more on the preventive side, more on preventive services, more on sending people to some of the kind of treatment programs like the diabetes management programs there. And so the opportunity within Medicaid is broader. And finally, though, if we look at the people who are dual eligibles, they really have a substantial share of chronic illnesses, 55% of three or more. But when I look at that, I also think, well, a lot of Medicare beneficiaries have very similar levels of functional impairment. I mean, it's different, but it's not so substantially different on chronic illness. It really involves really thinking about how you manage the cognitively or mentally impaired, because that's where the biggest difference between the dual eligible population and other Medicare beneficiaries occurs. So in conclusion, we're really now looking at, and Melanie's alluded to being able to put together Medicare and Medicaid spending. So in this analysis that we did with the Urban Institute, we looked at within the dual eligible population, are there some who are higher spenders and some who are lower? And we found, interestingly enough, that if you look at the top 10% of Medicare spenders and the top 10% of Medicaid spenders, they're actually somewhat different people, even though they're both dual eligibles. And only about 100,000 people fall into the category of being a high spender in both Medicare and Medicaid. And that's largely because as we need to look forward at different ways to look at these populations, the subgroup analysis, which Melanie alluded to, was so critical. Because here you see that the top spenders in Medicare are really top spenders because of their acute care utilization. And those are services that Medicare can and should be able to better control. Whereas the top spenders that end up on Medicaid are often in nursing facilities and are also people who are using long-term care services in the community. And they actually spend a little less on acute care because their big spending is on long-term care. So in conclusion, I think as we look at and try and figure out how to better manage both technology, where there's not a lot of it, unfortunately, on the long-term care side, so most of the technology control would come in looking at the acute care services, we need to also think about how to manage different types of chronically ill patients and how the two programs can either work together better or work better within each program for the chronically ill. And I think that's where we will see better outcomes and lower costs if we can really zoom in on the disability populations and the differences by subgroup. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Diane. Well, Bruce Chernoff of SCAN Foundation, you've also been thinking a lot about this same group that we've been discussing, those with a rising prevalence of chronic disease and also often the aged and the costs attendant those. What else do we need to know about this population?
Well, thank you, Susan, and I really want to pick up on where Diane left off. I think those last couple of slides are incredibly important in our thinking here. And as we wait for the slides to come up, we're almost there, folks. That looks good. Terrific. So as I begin my presentation, I wanted to start in kind of a similar place, which is that you have to really look at the folks who are getting care and what their needs are. And that really helps us think about targeting and building better programs. And I think building off this notion that the Medicare and Medicaid high spenders are different is a critically important thing for everybody to take away today. And my first slide sort of picks up on that point, which is those with chronic conditions, that's only half the battle. Those with chronic conditions and functional limitations together really drive a lot more of the high-cost Medicare spending. And we'll come to why that is in a second. So chronic conditions are really important. We spent a lot of time today talking about people and their diseases, being defined by your disease. Well, the reality is that function is an incredibly important piece of this, your ability not only to care for yourself in a medical context, but to care for yourself in a personal context. And when you start to factor in this notion of function, function in the way you live your life, not the way you live your medical life. So I want to pick up on something Joe said at the very beginning and turn it on its head. Consumers aren't patients in waiting. Patients are people in waiting. So trying to get back to the place where most people, even those people who are chronically ill, even those people who have cognitive impairments or serious mental, chronic mental illness, they're still people most of the time. They still spend most of their time out and about in the world, and that world is not defined by hospital beds, ADTR functions, doctor's offices, or call triage centers. And so thinking about the role that function plays in disease and the way that function plays a role in people's lives is incredibly important if we're going to look at how we build effective programs and target appropriately. And this chart simply goes on to say that when you add in functional impairments, regardless of the number of chronic conditions, functional impairments is a really important cost driver in the lives of those with chronic illnesses, regardless of the number of chronic conditions that they have. Again, sort of echoing off of Diane's point, which is sort of, you know, how do Medicare and Medicaid hold hands? And you know, Melanie, I know why you're here, because it's this, you know, it's this slide. You know, who are the duals? Who are the pre-duals? And what this slide starts to raise is this whole issue of the pre-duals. What does a good duals program look like? So when you look at individuals who have chronic illnesses and substantial functional limitations, half of them are duals, but roughly half of them are not. So these are folks who run the risk of spending down because their medical problems get them by the tail and becoming duals. And I think in an environment where, as we watch boomers start their retirement, we see folks with fewer financial resources than they might have had earlier on, this becomes sort of a critical problem and a cost driver over the next 10 or 15 years for us. So when we in the SCAN Foundation start to talk with folks about what they really want, we decided that we would do almost 20 focus groups across the country last year and then a series of polls. And what we did was to choose to talk with individuals who were 45 to 65 and really in a caregiving role, and those who were kind of 65 plus who were either caregiving or care receiving. And this represents a word cloud that just sort of looks at the most important language that folks used. And I think it's really important that we look at this because these are all individuals who could exquisitely describe either the caregiving or the care-receiving processes. And, you know, I'm a general internist by training. I love the medical system as much as the next guy. But I would offer to you that there's very little medical stuff on this slide. And with all due respect to a lot of the great programs we've built, you don't see this riddled with disease management, palliative care, hospice. It kind of goes back to my earlier point, which is function is incredibly important, and individuals define themselves by the function they retain. And if you really look at the words that are up there, like community and independent, I mean, that's how people think of themselves. And so as we start to think about the kinds of solutions that we want, where does technology fit? So why is this a technology talk? I want to leave you with a few points. And I think the points really are that you have to really ask, what's the problem that we're trying to solve here? So there's very little evidence, picking up on one of the earlier points, that surgical robots add much value. So the reality is that surgical robots, at least at this point in time, for the data that's available, solve a marketing problem for hospitals. So if you're in a competitive environment, it's good to say you have a robot, and my friends who are surgeons love them. So it actually is, you know, kind of keeping your medical staff intact. That's a different problem. Solving a marketing problem is way different than solving a clinical care or care coordination problem. And so when we start to look at the population that has substantial medical problems but substantial functional limitations, thinking carefully then about the problem you're trying to solve is key. And it really may be that it's more of a low-tech solve we're looking at. So what's the role of the telephone and the pieces of technology that do work where there is evidence? So things like remote patient monitoring and medicine optimization, those are places where a little bit of technology, a small investment, can go a long way. So that's take home number one. You know, if we're going to introduce technology, what is the problem we're trying to solve with it? The second thing about technology is in this environment, in the environment that Diane described and that I'm trying to build on, technology is not an end-to-end solution. Okay, technology rarely solves any problems in the seriously, chronically ill, functionally limited person's life. It is a tactic, not a strategy. So at the end of the day, to just introduce a piece of technology is going to get you nothing but costs and actually maybe more risks than benefits. Most older individuals, when they get sent home from a complicated hospital stay, get technology. The DME provider comes out and drops something off. And, you know, if there isn't a substantial and robust care coordination plan there, whether it's being driven by the family or the healthcare system or others, that piece of technology may bring more risk than benefit. And so it kind of gets to the point that technology without a good care coordination plan is of questionable value. And I think that as we build systems, And really, Melanie, as we think about the work that you're doing in the Care Coordination Office, it's not just about the Medicare model of care in that sort of nice model of care way we all like to think about it. It is the model of care coordination and person-centered care coordination that is going to be at issue here. So as you look at the states who are proposing, you know, we would really encourage you to look hard at not just is there a plan for the pills and the this's and the that's and the in and outs of the nursing home, but what is the plan of care that really supports people's goal towards retaining the function they have, even if they have serious illness or have had some functional loss. Now, my last point, picking up on one of the comments in the audience, is this issue of targeting. Targeting is really, really, really important. And you're not going to solve, and again, I think Diane's slides really hint at this, for the high-spending Medicare population, you know, medically oriented solves are probably going to take you a long way. And so the really nice article that was published in Health Affairs that covered some of these data sort of make the observation, well, that's a place where a medical home may make a lot of sense because you have folks with lots of doctors and nurses and pharmacists and others. And kind of coordinating the medical cats is half the battle. So that's a really good place to start. But for the Medicaid population, where the needs may be more functional and community-based, the model of care may look very different, and the medical home may not be the solution because the problem with the medical home is, you know, we're glad to talk to you in a medical context, or come right in. We have a same-day appointment. But for somebody whose needs may be more functional or socially related, being drawn into the medical system, being medicalized, may not be the solution. So we really encourage technology be used in a targeted fashion, and that, you know, what's the problem? What is the problem you're trying to solve? Are we really looking to solve a medical problem or a functional problem? Thanks.
Thanks very much, Bruce. And now to Susan Reinhart. Now that Susan, that we know who the chronically ill are, that their needs are not all the same, and we've talked about consumer engagement or patient engagement or person engagement and shared decision making, how do we bring all of those things together?
Thanks, Susan. I figured you left the best for last for best because you wanted the patient perspective, which I'm happy to try to bring to this discussion. Can you hear? Is this on? Okay. So what I really wanted to talk about is this idea that I know Ken does such a great job in all of his work talking about the need for better patient and family self-management and the need for tools for that. So as we talk about who are the chronically ill, how they're spending their dollars, the technology that is certainly has to be used by the patient and family, what are the patients telling us in any model that we might develop and use? And so a couple of years ago, we at the Public Policy Institute at AARP conducted a national survey of both patients and family caregivers asking, and these were people with multiple chronic conditions who had experienced transitions. So that's the focus of this work. And we talked about what their experience was, what their concerns were, and just to cut to the chase, many of these patients and caregivers talked about poor communication. So as we're talking about technology and the use of patient self-management tools, many of them didn't know that they even existed. So here's some of the data I just wanted to share with you that I see as the challenges for what at the end of the day we have to confront, which is, you know, 1 in 4 lack confidence in the healthcare system. They may love their doctor or their nurse practitioner, but the system is very overwhelming to them. We know from other literature that the average person on Medicare has 2 primary care physicians and 5 specialists across 4 different practice settings. So that's a lot to take on and to have some confidence that this is all going to work together. 30% said that when they went to visit their doctor, usually their doctor, that there wasn't enough information there to even have a conversation. Family caregivers particularly felt that. 21% said that providers do not talk to each other. And this is where it really gets to be very tricky. So we talk about adherence, how important it is that patients adhere to their medical regimen, but they get conflicting information. 1 in 4 are saying they get different information from 2 or more clinicians and that they feel their own health is suffering because of that. Now, this is the one that really got me when I saw this. You know,
27% said they admitted this. This is an admission on a survey where you know usually you don't want to admit things that you're doing. And these folks are saying they had not done something that was recommended by a healthcare professional, like get a prescription. So in other words, they were non-adherent. Most of them, 32%, said they didn't agree with what was being told. Now, we need much more work, and maybe some in this room know if there's more work on this. I certainly want to drill down into this. But it's a serious problem. We know, for example, adherence, that more than 30 years of research that I've seen on community-dwelling elders and prescriptions for them, about 25% of those prescriptions are inappropriate to begin with. So, and we know that polypharmacy is a huge deal. So my argument for years has been maybe it's a good thing that many of these people are non-adherent. They may be saving their own lives. So I really think whatever we do, we've got to be talking about this in a way that makes sense to people. We also don't talk – I didn't hear anybody talk about health literacy, for example. And a few years ago, that was really hot. I think we've got to come back to the hot health literacy issue. I remember one of the cases that – I think it was a Pfizer study that looked at this – was a woman who – this isn't necessarily a chronic care condition, but a woman who was taking care of her child who had an ear infection – and kept coming back, and the ear infection was getting worse and worse, and was a liquid antibiotic, which she was putting in the ear instead of the mouth. Because nobody showed her, she figured ear infection, you know, put the medication in that. We also know from the work on hotspots, for example, in Camden, that there was a gentleman there, many of you probably know this particular case. I think it's very telling. A person with diabetes who kept coming back into the ER, but there was certain pattern and what's going on here. Finally, someone said, well, let me see you give your insulin. Now, why that wasn't done years before is beyond me, but that's the nurse in me, I suppose. But what he was doing was putting the syringe, he had the bottle on the table, putting the syringe in and pulling up instead of flipping the bottle. So, in other words, in the beginning of the prescription, he was probably getting the insulin he needed. But as the insulin, you know, as he kept doing, then he was just getting air and injecting air. So it was like a big revelation. Well, now we know how to manage this person's condition. So this, to me, is getting into a health workforce issue as well as healthcare delivery. Are we giving anticipatory guidance, which used to be fundamental to the art and science of healthcare? We keep talking about the technology, but there's an art here very deeply involved in communication and culture and outside of hospitals, what goes on. So we used to do anticipatory, like, you're going to find this is going to happen, and when this happens, this is what you should be doing. And we also used to do what was known as teach back. So let me tell you how to do it. Now show me how you're going to be doing it. These are really basic interventions, Ken, when you're talking about, we know, these are basic skills that seem to have been lost. We did a focus group with caregivers about a year ago. These were diverse caregivers. And this is not uncommon. This is a gentleman, federal worker, pretty high-level federal worker for a number of years, retired, went to take his mother home. He is a caregiver. Went to take her home from the hospital, and they said, you're going to have to give these injections. Nobody showed him how to give an injection. He thought, okay, I'm just going to go home. He started, and they were abdominal. They must have been like heparin or something, right? So he goes home and starts giving this, bruising the whole body, not knowing what he's doing, and wound up taking him back to the hospital, in which case the healthcare team in the emergency room said, what have you been doing to your father? This is the experience of family caregivers. Well, it might have been good if you showed me how to do this. So there's a lot going on, I think, with trying to get to that point where we're talking about confident, knowledgeable, skilled people who can be engaged, but they've got to better understand what's happening to themselves so that they can do it.
Great. Well, with that, miraculously, we have ended this part of the program almost exactly on time. So let's take advantage of that and get started and go to our break. And then we'll come back for a very vigorous discussion where we try to knit all these perspectives together and get to some more discussion about actionable solutions. So enjoy the coffee break. See you back here in 15 minutes.
10 minutes.
10.
Remember, it's your time.
Okay, 10 minutes.
And
Speaking of actionable facts, the restrooms are in this corner, out the hall and turn left. And please do get back in 10 minutes.